And here we go, Kabbalah, You and the Cosmic Christ, Part 1. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to give a little background information first. And this first session is what Kabbalists would call very Hodian. There's a lot of information to digest because we have to do a kind of a setting up process for the first session. And what I would love you to do is email me questions if you've got questions at the end of the session, because then we can make the rest of the series a real Kabbalah group, because Kabbalah is always taught through question and answer. What will usually happen is the teacher spiels for about 15 minutes and then you have questions, and then it leads on from there. However, let's begin at the very beginning. To quote Richard Rohr, Father Richard Rohr, Christ is not Jesus's surname. And that's one of the things that so many Christians kind of think is the truth, that Jesus is Christ, Christ is Jesus, and that is it. Jesus embodied the cosmic Christ. And our job is also to embody the cosmic Christ. We probably won't do it the way he did it, but even if we do it for a second or two in a day, we're doing an extraordinary job. So how I got to this is that I was what you'd call an armchair Christian, which meant I turned up at Christmas and sometimes at Easter and occasionally at Evensong, and I would have quoted St. Augustine quite happily, which was, God grant me chastity, constancy, and patience, but not yet. And then I got married to an atheist. I was quite late marrying for the first time at 32, and it didn't bother me that he was an atheist at all. Why would it? And then 5 months after we were married, Henry was diagnosed with terminal cancer. We did all the alternatives, diet and everything, and that certainly held it. But he decided to go for a dramatic new treatment that it enhanced the immune system rather than destroying it. Unfortunately, they found he had a heart murmur. He couldn't have it, so they gave him chemo, and he was dead in 2 weeks. However, on his deathbed, 2 nights before he died, I was in the hospital with him alone. He was unconscious, and the hospital chaplain came along. He was a Catholic, and he said, "What is your religion?" And I said, "Church of England," because that's what I wrote on all the forms. And he said, "What is your religion? What is your husband's religion?" And I said, "He's an atheist." And the priest said, "I'm sorry, my dear, but if he doesn't believe in our Lord Jesus Christ, he can't go to heaven." Now, that was the wake-up call. That was basically the wake-up call, because that man must have been an angel, because it just made me think, that's not right. And I'd never really thought about it before. I'm of the generation, I'm 61, where I was growing up before so many of the people came into the United Kingdom as immigrants. And I was really unaware of other religions and the validity of them. So it was a terrible shock, because I just thought Christianity was in the background and perfectly okay and didn't really matter and everybody went to heaven and that kind of thing. But at Henry's funeral, he had a Church of England funeral, walking up the aisle after his coffin, I was basically hearing him damned to hell. And at that point, I threw Jesus out of the window. And when I had recovered a little, I went into the New Age. I studied healing, because that was the only thing that helped him while he was dying. And I got into all the chakras and Buddhism and all that kind of thing. But after a while, I realized that my problem was Christianity. And what I was really doing was putting my problem in a corner, covering it with a nice pink throw, putting tea lights and crystals on top of it and pretending it wasn't there. But I was never going to really heal until I went back into Christianity and worked out what it really was. That was my calling. So I decided to go to Birmingham University and study New Testament Greek, which was great. It was a wonderful experience. Goodness knows how people study a whole theology degree as well as New Testament Greek, because just doing the Greek was enough for me. And then, of course, I learned that there are 32,000 versions of the New Testament in Greek. Fortunately, only about 5,000 of them differ in any great respect. So I wasn't really going to get to the truth there. But I wanted the truth. And it was very useful reading the Gospels in Greek, because the translations are quite interesting and quite biased, perhaps you could say. Certainly slanted, depending on the Bible you read. And then I was very lucky in meeting a Jewish man. And he was at the furthest end of his rope from Judaism as I was from Christianity. So we were perfectly matched at that point. He came to my teacher of healing and she couldn't handle him. And she sent him off to a man in London called Warren Kenton or Zev Ben Shimon Halevi for his Jewish name, because she thought that Jonathan would be better off learning from Halevi. He went down there. He really, really liked it. He told me about it, and I said, ask Halevi if I can come too. And he was going, no, I don't think you can. You've got to go to his workshops. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. But bless him, Warren said immediately that anybody's partner was welcome to come. So Jonathan and I went down to London every Thursday night, three turns a year, for the most of our marriage. And when we broke up, a couple of years later, when Lion and I got together, we also travelled down to London to go to this workshop. And this is the grounding that I had in the Jewish mystical tradition with a Jewish group. It was very much an open group at the time. Everybody was welcome. It's closed down quite a lot now. Warren is very interested in his books and getting them absolutely right. Lion is his publisher. And when I started trying to understand Christianity and Kabbalah, Warren told me quite clearly, that's your job and Michael Hatwick's job. Michael Hatwick is an American in Washington, D.C., and we've done quite a lot of work together and we published his book. But it was my job and my task to get down and dirty, as it were, and find out what the problem was. So if we start with page one of the PowerPoint, this is a beautiful image of the cosmic Christ. It's not of Jesus. It's the cosmic Christ. It's the power of creation holding the world in its hands. It's a picture from Toledo Cathedral, which I found and bought some beautiful images from there when I was on a Kabbalistic conference down in Toledo. So that's the cosmic Christ. Woo! So let's start with what is Kabbalah? That's page two. Kabbalah is the Jewish mystical tradition. It became the Western mystical tradition. It was formulated by what we would call the Hebrews before they actually became Jewish, if you see what I mean. And in the first temple, they had the menorah, which you will have heard of. It was a seven-branched golden candlestick made out of one piece of gold. And basically, they worked out, through observation, the patterns of creation. The one we're going to be working with primarily tonight is the pattern of four. And this is from the observation of the four great elements. Of course, there are many more elements of that. But the elements of earth, water, air, and fire. So on the menorah, if you're watching live, you can see where my cursor is. The bottom world is earth. The second one inside the menorah from the bottom is water. The third one is air. And the top one is fire. Now, from observation, if you just look at the sky in the daytime, you'll see that the sun is the source of the heat, which comes through the air. In the air are the clouds, which are water, which falls to the earth, and the water stands on the earth and falls through the earth. So all these four elements blend into each other. And of course, what they didn't know at the time, but we know now, is the heart of the earth is molten. So that takes it to the Chinese system, the five-element system of metal, molten rock. So you've got all the systems working together immediately. The great thing about Kabbalah and the Tree of Life is that it's just scaffolding. You can hang anything on it. I mean anything. You can hang writing a book on it. You can hang going on an expedition on it. And it will tell you through the patterns of the Sephirot and the four levels exactly whether you've got everything in place or not. Hopefully by the end of these six sessions you may get a better idea of that, but you're just going to have to stick with me and trust in it for the moment. Now the menorah's picture is on the right, and on the left is the Tree of Life. The Tree of Life was a sort of updating of the pattern of the menorah, which was created in the 11th century to make it easier. And you're probably looking at it right now and thinking, not quite. That looks a lot more complicated. But that Tree of Life is in the colours of the chakras, which may help you. There are different levels in the Tree of Life. And I think We'll get to those later on, but the most important thing is to say it's the menorah, it's ancient, it's 4,000 years old that we know of, and critically for the Christian tradition or those interested in the cosmic Christ, four is the pattern of the elements, and there are four Gospels. And that is not a coincidence. Next one. How did I manage to do that before? I can't work it out. I can do it, yes. There we go. So, the tree of life is mentioned in the Bible several times. It starts in Genesis. The idea of the tree of life is it is the way back to Eden. The tree of life is the tree. It's not the tree of knowledge. The tree of life is another tree in the Garden of Eden. In the Narnia books of C.S. Lewis, there is a kind of parallel story, if you've ever read The Magician's Nephew, when the world is being created and Diggory is sent off to another land to get an apple from the tree of life to protect Narnia. And in a parallel to the story, if Diggory had eaten that apple, then the apple would not have worked. But the fact that he did obey and brought the apple back to Aslan, it grew a whole new tree, which was the protection of Narnia. And the wardrobe through which the children went was made from that tree. But Genesis starts off the story of the tree of life. Later in the Hebrew Testament, she's mentioned in Proverbs. Wisdom is a tree of life to them that lay hold of her. So you can see already in the tradition, the idea of the tree of life is that it's a mystical thing, and it is a pathway or a scaffolding to help us to get back to God. It's mentioned in Acts 10:39, we are witnesses of all things which he did in the land of Jerusalem, whom they slew and hanged on a tree. Well, why would that be the tree of life? Well, because we'll see that the cross of Jesus is a representation of the tree of life. There are levels in the tree of life that represent the two malefactors and Jesus, which I'll be telling you about later in the course. But the fact that it says they hanged him on a tree rather than on a cross is very relevant for us, especially in tonight's webinar. Acts 13:29, when they had fulfilled all things that were written of him, they took him down from the tree and laid him in a tomb. And then when they'd filled all... I put that in twice, I beg your pardon, never mind. That's just to check you're watching. And Revelation, of course, mentions the tree of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give the right to eat from the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. So it's a pathway back. And Revelation 22:2, on each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. And I think that's very important. One of my books is called Leaves of the Tree, because the concept of the tree of life is that its fruit fall on everybody. The fruit is edible by everybody. You have to find the tree of life. All these esoteric traditions are meant to be quite difficult to find. You have to work for them. It's not handed to you on a plate. One of Jesus' sayings is, you shouldn't cast pearls before swine. Now, that's a bit tough, but the point of it is that if you gave everybody knowledge of the tree of life, knowledge of how you can place your astrological chart on the tree, how the tree works, the elements of the Sephirot, how the triads work and the paths work, you can use it for magic. And certain traditions like the Golden Dawn, which is a Hermetic Kabbalistic tradition, used it for sacred magic, but somebody called Aleister Crowley, whom you may have heard of, used it for twisting magic. And so it's always going to be a tradition that you have to try and find. Most mystical traditions you have to find. You have to prove that you're worthy of them, if you like. Now, the Tree of Life is in all sorts of faiths. So it's a common metaphor. Isis and Osiris came from the acacia tree, known as Lusaset. And the Egyptians called that the tree of life, the tree in which life and death are enclosed. And if you remember the Genesis story, if we ate from the tree of knowledge, we became like God, knowing the difference between good and evil. But if we ate from the tree of life, we would become immortal. So it's kind of confusing sometimes in the different cultures about tree of life and tree of knowledge. But if you think about the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that's mankind's biggest problem at the moment. We judge what is evil according to our egos and according to our training. So the tree of knowledge is always a dangerous thing, and it will give us life or death according to our beliefs. Tree of knowledge is basically why the law of attraction works. If you focus on judging things as being wrong, your life is going to become full of more things that you're going to judge as wrong. If you judge things as right, your life is going to become full of more things that you judge to be right. The tree of life is also in the Baha'i, where it can refer to the manifestation of God, a great teacher who appears to humanity from age to age. Well, that's a Christ figure. Kabbalistic teaching is that there is always a Messiah alive on the earth. Jesus was the most famous of them, but there is always a Messiah. The teaching is that Esther, in the book of Esther, is the first known female Messiah. They don't depend upon gender. You can be the anointed, as it would be called in the Kabbalistic tradition, for 3 minutes, 3 hours, 3 years, 30 years, or the whole of your life. But there is always one person who carries this crown. It might be you for 30 seconds in between two of them, who knows? But it's just one of those things that appears in all the archetypes. Yggdrasil, the North mythology, the Terrible One's horse, is also called the World Tree. And it's a giant ash tree that shelters all the nine Norse worlds. So the Kabbalistic Tree of Life has 10 Sephirot, but the Norse stories has 9 worlds and the World Tree. So it comes back to cosmic patterns. And at the bottom of Yggdrasil, there are 3 wells, the Well of Wisdom, Fate, and the Roaring Kettle, the source of many rivers. And 4 deer run across the branches of the tree and eat the buds. They represent the 4 winds. And just to digress very slightly, when people asked why there were 4 Gospels, Irenaeus, one of the early church fathers, said there must be 4 Gospels as there are 4 winds of the earth and 4 corners of the earth and 4 pillars of creation. So the early church fathers had an idea about this, and that is almost certainly why 4 Gospels were formulated into the canon of the Bible. It wasn't, as so many people think, that all the others were thrown out as heresy. It was just trying to make, at least I think so, I mean, always believe your own beliefs. I'm telling you what I've come to believe and what works for me. But your belief is what matters to you. And if you reject any of this, that's absolutely fine. I'm not going to come down on you like a ton of bricks for any reason. This is just hopefully going to be helpful to you in your tradition. So the Book of Mormon also has an exceedingly beautiful white tree known as the Tree of Life. And Nephi's vision, he's shown a virgin as beautiful and white as the Tree of Life. The virgin we know as Mary is presented as the mother of the Son of God after the manner of the flesh. So this is just to tell you that it's in all the traditions. Now, in the Bible, in the Hebrew tradition, the Tree of Life is frequently referred to in the prophets, Jeremiah specifically, and it's called the Asherah, the grove or the tree of life. We're going to be coming back to that in the second of the series, talking about the Sacred Mother in the first temple. But Asherah was one of the names given to the divine feminine in the early Hebrew teachings. The first temple had Asherah and Yahweh and the Holy of Holies. They had the masculine, the feminine, and the source of all. And the idea is that the masculine and feminine were pure and would give birth to pure souls in the world. In Jeremiah, after the ending of the first temple, before the building of the second temple, there's a great deal of crying out in the wilderness in Jeremiah, talking about the olive groves that are no longer festooned and the ash trees. And whenever it says olive grove or ash tree in the Hebrew, it actually translates as Asherah. So they're covering up this idea of the of a tree of life or the divine feminine. Many people will say the tree of life represents the divine feminine, but the whole point of it is it's totally balanced. It's masculine, feminine, and neutral as well. But it's very useful for bringing the feminine back into the tradition. So there's a couple of mentions. There's the whole Isis or Osiris story. There's the Mormon story. There's the Baha'i. There's also the legend of Mithras. There's the legend of Attis and Cybele. All talking about a divine child coming from a woman of great purity. And when we translate virgin, it's intended to mean pure. And in the Egyptian traditions, quite frequently, the mother of the king was also depicted as the wife of the king. So in the ancient tradition, the mother and the wife were seen as pretty much the same thing. The mother would give birth to the sacred child, who would marry the sacred woman, who would give birth to the sacred child, who would marry the sacred woman, who would give birth to the sacred child, who would marry the sacred woman. And Joseph Campbell tells of four levels of the stories of creation, which is the first understanding of the story of creation is of a goddess giving birth of herself. The second story is of a goddess fertilized by a god giving birth to the universe. The third story is of a god and a goddess working together for the universe. And the fourth story, which is the one that Christianity adopted, is of a male god who created the universe. So the feminine got slowly, steadily made less important and wiped out. Now, it's moot whether the story in Genesis is the first story or the second story, because it says quite clearly, Barashit Elohim, in the beginning the Elohim created. And Elohim is a Hebrew word of Eloah, which is feminine, goddess, but Him, Ohim, is masculine plural in Hebrew. It's a word that's not used anywhere else except Bible, Elohim. So the implication is it's a feminine goddess with a masculine plural ending, which sounds very much like an egg and sperm. Now, I don't think they knew about eggs and sperm back in those days, but I think it's probably the concept of the feminine being fertilized by the masculine. And this beautiful icon here showing Jesus in the center of the Tree of Life with all the disciples around him is depicting Jesus as the Tree of Life, the path back to Eden. Okay, we're on slide number 9 now, in case you're listening later and you want to catch up. And here is the diagram of what's known as Jacob's ladder on the left-hand side. And the story in Genesis is of Jacob falling asleep. He fell asleep with his head on a rock, God bless him, and dreamt about a ladder going up to heaven with angels ascending and descending it. And this is known as Jacob's ladder in the Kabbalistic tradition. And it's a way of demonstrating four different worlds, the four levels. You can see there's pink, purple, blue, and white. The top world, the ultimate tree of life, is the world of divinity. The second world, the blue one, which blends into the white at the top, is the world of spirit or heaven. The third one, which is purple and blends into the blue, is the world of form or emotion. That's the watery world. The top one is fire, the second one is air, the third one is water, and the fourth one is earth. That's the physical world. So if you think about it just in very, very simple terms, you have a brilliant idea, a flash of light. Then the inspiration becomes more clarified. So for example, a flash of light, I want to be of service. So there's a huge potentiality in that. This top world of emanation, known as Atzilut, is all potential. The second world of spirit is where you start to define things. The second world has up, down, left, right, day, night. So it's the place where binary thinking comes in, where duality starts. We'll go into it in more detail another time. The third world is where things are formed. For example, Let me see, how would be the best? Let's go with a horse. The first world would be the concept of a horse, a beautiful creature coming out of fire, the most beautiful, magnificent creature. The second part would be, this is a creature with four legs. We're going to define it just a little bit. And it can be male or it can be female. The third world is going to be, what kind of horse is it? And then things start getting really complicated. So it could be a Lipizzana, it could be Andalusian, it could be a Shire, it could be a Cob, it could be a Shetland pony. The form is made of all different kinds of things. And then the lower world, the physical world, is the actual manifestation of that horse. So there's wonderful concepts at the top, defining a little on the next way down, defining an awful lot more the way down for that, and then making manifest in the world. So it's the same image four times, four worlds. And you've got the tree of the life, tree of life on the left now in the next slide, and you've got Jacob's ladder on the right, and you can see quite clearly that Jacob's ladder is four versions of the tree of life. When we talk about the tree of life in the tradition that I'm trained in, which is known as the Toledano tradition, other traditions may differ, and they're all right. All the traditions are slightly different, but they're all hung on the same scaffolding, and they all work, which is wonderful. This one, the world that I'm circling now, the one on the left, would be the world of water, the world of forms. Because this is where we human beings spend nearly all our time, in our minds. Making forms out of everything, judging things, sorting things out, defining things, planning things, putting things together, thinking about things before we do them. And you'll see that these are two paintings that I've done there on the wall behind me in my office. And one of the things you're encouraged to do if you study this tradition is to start doing your own paintings of the trees and ladders, because they show you your own issues. The things that go wrong tell you everything you need to know. And we painted a giant ladder for a conference we did in Birmingham a few years ago, and I just kept messing up the sephira in the middle on the left, the circle in the middle on the left called Gevura, which represents discipline, discernment and judgment, because I was in too much of a hurry and the diagram was trying to tell me to slow down and be more disciplined about what I was doing. So oddly enough, this cosmic pattern can tell you things that you perhaps don't notice yourself. Now, the reason I put make straight the way of the Lord, which is in all four Gospels, but I've quoted it from John, is that if we look at the teachings of the Bible and we look at the teachings of Jesus, we tend to understand that the idea of Jesus was to take away the need for priests. Let's all laugh out loud at that one, shall we? We've even got quite a few ministers on this webinar, so we'll all be chuckling at that one. The idea is that Jesus came to teach us to be mystics so that we would have our own direct communication with God. He's very clear all the way through. I and the Father are one. And that if you believe, he does say believe in me, but he's talking of the Christ at that level. When we talk about the Gospels in another of the webinars, it's very, very clear they're all working on completely different levels. John is working at the level of the cosmic Christ the whole way through. It's meant to be read as a meditation with you in the place of Jesus. And the great I am statements at all points in the New Testament Greek, Jesus says, I am, I am. He never just says, I am, in those seven statements. He says, I am, I am. In some Bibles, it's translated as I am in capitals for the emphasis. But my teacher of Greek at Birmingham University did quite agree with it when I said to him, does this mean that Jesus is invoking the name of I am, the ultimate name of God? And he said, yes, there are plenty of scholars who believe that when Jesus says, I am, he is referring to God the transcendent, God beyond, and God the immanent within himself. We all have God the immanent within us, and we are all capable of contacting God the transcendent. When you get that link, that's Christ consciousness. So Jesus is speaking in the Gospel of John as the Christ consciousness. So when he says, I am the way, the truth, the life, nobody comes to the Father except through me. It's equally valid translation, and there are many versions of the Greek which also say this, but one's chosen in the end, that say, nobody comes to the Father except as I am, which makes a completely different ball game out of the whole thing. Next slide has the four worlds which I've painted separately. On the left is Asiya, which is usually coloured red. Yetzira, which is the world of water, I've coloured in the chakras again, but it would generally be coloured purple. Berea is the colour of blue, the sky, that is air. And Atzilut is white, that's fire. You can also paint Atzilut in gold. Each of these trees is identical at a different level. Each one has 11 aspects to it, 10 circles, and one non-sephira, the black hole. The black hole is what I call the cat flap, which is what links each world. It represents the throat chakra in us. It's how you communicate between levels. You don't need to worry about that too much now. But the point of all this is that as above, so below. Whatever you do in the physical world will work its way through these four worlds until it affects the divine. And anything that happens at the divine will work its way down the worlds too. The lowest world, Asiya, is very coarse and very fragile. And you tend to think of the physical world as not being fragile, but one meteorite in the earth is virtually exploded. We die. That world ends. Each lifetime, that world ends. The earth will be destroyed. The sun will implode. The universe will be destroyed. But at Atzilut, nothing that has ever been loved is ever destroyed. In Atzilut, everything that has ever been loved still exists in full potential. In the bottom third of Atzilut, which links into the world of Berea, the world of spirit, are all the creatures that have gone extinct, all the creatures that have never been born yet, and the level of the soul in Atzilut are all the human souls. It may not just be humans, it may be beyond this planet. I'm quite sure there are other sentient beings out there, but I'm going to say humans because our knowledge at the moment is only on this planet. All the human souls that have not yet been born, ever, are in the soul triad of Atzilut. They are in pure potential. So let's go with the fours. Four worlds, four levels, four elements, four gospels, and we can see the pattern emerging in the great images of the medieval times and before. We've got this idea of the four creatures who are they come from the book of Ezekiel, and Ezekiel's vision tells of the four creatures, tells about the appearance like as of a man on a throne. And the four creatures are the bull, the lion, the eagle, and the human. As a general rule, we are taught that the lion is the physical world, the physical creature. The bull is the psychological world. And generally, people put the human in the spiritual world and the eagle in the divine world because it's flying. As Kabbalists, we change that slightly differently, because we say that the human is in the divine world, because the perfect human is representing the divine, the image of God. And the eagle flies. So we would say that was in the world of spirit. But wherever you want to put them is completely up to you. The important thing is there's four of them, telling us that there's four levels and that the mystics understood that. The temple, the first temple and the second temple, Herod's temple, had four courts. So again, we have this pattern of four, just simply again and again to say, if we've got all four levels, we have a manifestation of the divine. If you've got three levels, you can have a manifest, something from the divine that is formed but is never manifest, or you can start from the bottom and create something that isn't divine. And of course, as human beings, we are creators, and we create things that are sacred or profane. If they are in no touch, they don't touch any of the other worlds, they are very fragile and then generally fall away. But if we use the four worlds, then we will create something that lasts. In the temple, the physical world was represented by the court of the Gentiles, where anybody could go. You didn't have to have the sacred mikveh bath for that. Anybody could go. That's where Jesus turned over the tables of the money changers. That was where people would go. Foreigners could go. If you wanted to go any further in the temple, you had to have a special token. And that's why you went to one of the money changers, because the idea was the money changers would change any kind of foreign currency for a token that would take you through to the next stage of the temple, if you were allowed to go through to that. And of course, just like many financial institutions, they perhaps got a little bit greedy, and I suspect they were ripping people off, and Jesus wasn't having any of that. Second court of the temple was known as the court of the women. That's where the families went. And the court of the women was, at the first temple, by far the most popular of the courts, because everybody could go there, hang out. It had grass and trees and fruit. It was beautiful and it was lovely. And that's where they would go for the festival of the tabernacles. And everybody was welcome there. The court after that was the court of the men, which was where sacrifices were taken. Now, in the first temple, sacrifices were purely vegetable. Animal sacrifice only came in with the loss of the feminine. Now, there was a way for the women to get through in the first temple, to get to the fourth area, which we now call the Holy of Holies, which was absolutely banned to them at the sound of the second temple. There was a pathway for the women to go through, because they went to worship the Asherah, the feminine, in the Holy of Holies area, and the men would go to the worship Yahweh in the Holy of Holies. And offerings of bread were given to Asherah and wine were given to Yahweh, which the high priest and priestess would take up to the divine, bless, and bring back, representing the Christ consciousness, to give back to the men and the women outside. So that basically is an outline of the communion as we have it now. In the first temple, a holy man and a holy woman was allowed into the Holy of Holies. A man or a woman was allowed to the pillar of the Asherah, which was just outside the Holy of Holies. But generally, the men would do their own thing in the court of the men. But the women didn't see that as a problem then, because they had the access to the divine and they didn't want to take the children. So we have to always remember that in so-called primitive societies, children were in the charge of the mother up to approximately 7, and then in the charge of the father after the age of 7. Up to the age of 7, they learnt their faith. They learned how to live in the tribe. They learned how to gather food. They learned how to make baskets. They learned how to make things with the mother. And then the women, too, would go to the father to learn how to hunt. And to learn how to hunt, you work together in a tribe. So that part of it was very important for the women, too, because it was all about working together to stalk an animal. And understanding that your life depended on the other. At puberty, the women went back to the women and the men went out to become hunters. But the women were still taught the ethics of this so that they would know how the men thought and they would understand each other. And this is what we've got down the oral tradition. There's a fair amount of evidence of it in some very ancient texts dating back to Jesus' time, not a lot before then, obviously, because people didn't read and write a lot. So we have to go on references read between the lines in the Bible and other ancient texts. But we think that's how it was. We certainly do know that the Asherah was worshipped by the women, because one of the reasons why she became unpopular was that the women would weave awnings and coverings and beautiful things for her. And I completely get that. I went to a flower and fabric festival at a church in Brixham recently when I was working for Radio Devon. They asked me to open it. And it was just covered. The church was covered with this beauty that the women had made. I'm not saying men can't do it, but as a general rule, it's not what they want to do. But the exquisiteness of these wonderful hangings and quilts and pictures that had been made. And these, according to the book of Jeremiah, were all laid at the feet of the Asherah, and she was incredibly beautiful. Whereas I think the men's style perhaps wasn't quite so popular. And it's quite possible, human nature being what it was, that the boys were fed up with not being able to go to the Asherah once they got to puberty. And it all got very silly, because let's face it, religion gets very, very silly very, very frequently. Now, the next slide is the one which is showing the Tree of Life I painted in the middle, Jacob's Ladder on the right, and the Orthodox cross, the Russian Orthodox cross on the left. And this, I think, is a really beautiful clue about these four levels in the Gospels. You'll notice on the Orthodox cross that the top cross is smaller, the second one is the cross with Jesus' arms out, and the third one at the bottom is at an angle. If you've ever wondered why the angle, the teaching is that these are the levels of the three malefactors, which are written of in the book of Luke. They're called thieves, but the Greek says malefactors, so we don't know what they did wrong. The first one represents the lowest level, which is the first horizontal line on the Tree of Life in the centre there. That's the line between Hod and Netzach. And this is the line which is known as the liminal line. Everything below it is to do with the ego and the physical body. And everything below this line is in the subconscious. It's automatic reaction. This is what we do again and again and again. And the malefactor at this level says to Jesus, "You're the Son of God, get us off this. You can, if you're the Son of God, you can get us down from this." Because he's just looking for somebody else to get him out of his state. And that's what the ego consciousness basically does. You see it in the newspapers, you see it all over social media. They should change everything so that I can feel comfortable. And that's the absolute definition of the ego consciousness. The second malefactor is at the level of the second horizontal line up between two sephirot called Gevurah and Hesed. Now, Hod and Netzach at the bottom one represent thought and action. Gevurah and Hesed represent discernment or judgment and loving kindness or mercy. So you can think without discernment and you can act without mercy. You can do whatever you like down at the bottom levels. But once you've got up to this level between Gevurah and Hesed, it's known as the soul triad. This is the level of free will and consciousness. The second malefactor says, "Leave him alone. We deserve what we've got. But he is innocent." So can you see the different level of consciousness there? That person understands that he is receiving his karma for what he did and that it is not right to ask to be set free from that. But the second he has accepted who he is and that he deserves his punishment, Jesus' response is, "Today you shall be with me in paradise." Now, that in itself is pretty well all the teaching you need from the Tree of Life, all the teaching you need from Christianity, all the teaching you need from any tradition whatsoever, which is if you blame, if you won't take responsibility, you're going to fall off the tree and you're going to go round again, because this angle of that lower part of the cross means that you are going round the karmic loop again. You're in samsara. You will be reborn to relearn this lesson. Whereas the thief would probably, the second one, would probably be reborn, but he would get choice in his life. If you know about the Buddhist bardos, the first 3 days after death, you're said to face all your own demons. If you know they're your demons and you can work your way through them, then in another life you get a choice what your life is going to be. If you don't know they're your demons, you will be chased back into humanity. The Buddhist tradition says you might even be born in a pig or something like that, because you're so afraid of the demons that you race back to Earth. The Kabbalistic tradition does say you cannot be reborn as an animal, or if you were, you would not return to being human, because being an animal, you can't hold human consciousness. And I heartily recommend the books of Terry Pratchett, which are extremely funny apart from being very wise, and the story of the witches, which starts with Weird Sisters, is a beautiful series of books about three witches, which expands into four witches, where they teach the importance of understanding the level that you're on. Now, the witches in Terry Pratchett are very, very clear about the fact that what you do rebounds. Whatever you do rebounds. And they say that you have to learn magic in order not to use it. It's almost a failure if you have to use the magic. What they use is headology, because they understand the psyche of people. But what happens when we don't work from anywhere higher than the ego is that we're going to go around and we're going to suffer. Whereas if we're working at the second level, we're going to see things as they really are, as opposed to what they think they are. On the third level, we've got the cross of Jesus, and that is between the Sephirot of Bina and Chochmah. And as you look at this on the third level, you can see that the cross goes from the very top down to the very centre, across the black hole, which is known as Da'at, the non-Sephira, the place of knowledge or transformation where you change worlds. So you've got the top cross of Jesus, which is changing worlds, going through to a higher world. You've got the second cross of the person who realizes who they are, and you've got the third cross of the person who doesn't realize who they are. At Keter, the crown of the Tree of Life, this is known as it's the crown chakra, or it's also known as the Christ consciousness. The bottom of the Tree of Life, Malkut, is known as the kingdom. So you have the crown at the top and the kingdom at the bottom. Okay, moving on to the next image. Okay, so we've got the four levels. At the top level, we've got divinity. At the second level, we've got the Christ consciousness. At the third level, we've got metanoia, repentance. And at the bottom level, we've got unrepentance. So the malefactor who doesn't understand is unrepentance. Between that level of the cross and the cross of the soul, we've got repentance. Now, repentance simply does mean think again. It doesn't mean go around saying, I'm sorry. It means think anew. Repent. Metanoia. Think again. Have another go at it. Have another way round. Between the cross of Jesus and the top of the Tree of Life is your higher self, your Buddha self, your Christ self. And at the very top, you've got divinity. And you can see the image here of the malefactors with Jesus. They are shown at slightly different levels. On the PowerPoint, you see the one on the right-hand side is just below the one on the left-hand side, and Jesus is higher than both of them. So your God self, which you can access consciously through meditation, it's pretty much where you get to the theta level, you can actually access that. From meditation, we go from the beta level to the alpha level to the theta level. And it's always quite tricky when you start meditation, because once you get to the alpha level, that's the level that would represent to the world of spirit. And it's full of ideas. And when I start to sit down and meditate, the first thing that happens is I have great ideas. Oh, I could do this. Oh, I must do that. I could do the other. I could do this. And it's quite difficult to have the discipline to say, let that go, move on. Sometimes I'll have a notebook and write down a couple of them, but let it go and move on to the higher level, because that's the level where you're going to receive the fuel you need to practice those ideas. But at the level of the Christ consciousness, the crown chakra, or the crown of the tree of life, there is no separation between you and God, and you know it. And that's where Jesus was. At the level below that, you've become, you're who you hope to be, who you are meant to be, who you came to develop yourself to be, the level of the soul. And you can take the story of Jesus there as an example of enlightenment, of the idea of dissolving suffering through consciousness and forgiveness. Below that is who you really are, which is the development of Jesus' soul as a healer and leader, and how you think for yourself about your ambition, your individuation, your leadership, how you make commitments, decisions and free will, and how you bring yourself to your soul. And at the lowest level, it's who the world says you are, who you think you are, the physical reality of you, the genetics, the family, the tribe, the environment, religion, beliefs and ego. So at the bottom level, who the world says you are, that's pretty much medicine, allopathic medicine. That's your tribe, that's your family, that's your school, that's your workplace. That's everything that goes round and round and round, who will tell you who they think you are. The Jesuits had a saying, give me a child until he is seven and I will give you the man. And that's why the mother was so important in ancient days, because she was the one who trained you into who you thought you were. Did you think you were good? Did you think you were stupid? Did you think you were a Christian? Did you think you were a Muslim? Did you think you were Egyptian? It's all about the placing of you in a safe vessel. And if your raising up to the age of seven was frightening, you will not have a safe vessel to have built the rest of your life on. As Richard Rohr teaches, what you're doing is you're basically at this level creating the vessel and the laws that you learn which ones you can break. But you've got to have a strong vessel, a strong childhood, a secure and confident childhood of knowing who everybody thinks you are, on which to stand to become an individual. If you haven't got that, you will do one of two things, according to this tradition, and it's Jungian as well. You will either individuate too early, which means you didn't have a secure base to run to when you were in trouble, so you went independent. You took it on yourself to be the person who decided when to fight and when to fly. You became the rebel. You became the outsider. Quite a few of you are going to identify with that immediately. You became the one who said, I'm going to do it my way. Or, if you didn't individuate too early, you will stay in the position of fright until you find a sect. And you will become a fundamentalist in something. Because the ego has to have this security. If you weren't given it early, you're going to have to create it yourself and reject other people as the rebel. Or you're going to have to find a different tribe that you can belong to. And because you didn't learn the importance of how rules can be broken safely, you know, that time when you didn't go to bed when your parents told you not to go to bed and you got punished for it. So you knew what the rules were about going to bed and you got a good night's sleep. And you actually knew what was going on. Yes, later in your teenage years, you'd stay out all night and you'd have fun. But on a night when you were at home on your own, you'd go to bed like a sensible person because that's what the training was. Whereas if as a child you were allowed to stay up all night, whenever you wanted to, you had no bedtime, you had no boundaries or anything like that. You saw what the parents were up to. You saw what they watched on TV. Your psyche will have been so shattered that later on you're very likely to join something that says you don't watch TV at all. Or if you watch TV, you watch this and you stay with us and we will keep you safe and you will give us your life. And that's where fundamentalists will come from. If you have a strong container or if you have become an individual too early, you will still seek. Most of the people who study Kabbalah have had a fractured childhood, but they are not new souls. The new souls are the ones who tend to become the fundamentalists. old souls that have gone the wrong way are the leaders of the fundamentalists, because they lead from what's known as a negative teferet, a place of pride. And they are the ones who will embrace actual evil. The ones who do the blowing up with the bombs in Islam at the moment are the ones who have gone into fundamentalism because they had a fragmented youth. They're doing it because their tribe tells them to, and because they believe it's the right thing to do. But if you have become an individual too early, you are still seeking for some form of comfort, and you will usually find it within yourself in seeking a mystical tradition. The ones who seek the mystical tradition are the ones who are seeking God as a friend straight out. And if you haven't had a simple upbringing or good upbringing, you're going to have an awful lot of times in the wilderness and desert while you seek that. It's going to be lonely, it's going to feel isolated, and it's going to feel uncomfortable. So the great thing about the internet, the wonderful thing about the internet, is you can find mystical spiritual tribes on the internet. You can sometimes find them in the physical world as well, but usually if you've got one in the physical world, it's going to end up with a structure, it's going to end up with a leader, it's going to end up with the rules and regulations, which can either end up becoming straight back down to the ego, which is the tribal aspect of you've got to study Reiki this way. If you study that Reiki that way, you can't come to our group. So you've gone straight back into the tribe. The message of the mystic is that you don't live in the tribe. You're on the edge of it, always. Always on the edge of the tribe. You are a fringe dweller. You will become the shaman. You will become a good priest, hopefully, because you are the one that's going to help people lift their hearts to God, because you know how hard it is to get there yourself. That's the true calling, to become a priest in the mystical tradition. You're there to open the door to other people. Now, I mentioned a little earlier the kingdom. The bottom of each of the trees of life is known as the kingdom, Malkut. In the book of Esther, when she takes on the robes of Messiahhood, it says in the Hebrew Testament, she put on the kingdom. It's usually translated as she puts on her royal robes or she put on her crown, but it's clear she put on the kingdom. Now, the top world, Atzilut, is the world of the divine or the world of God. So the kingdom of God is the bottom sephira of the top world of Atzilut, which is the top sephira of the psychological world of Yetzirah, the world of the chakras. So if you are accessing your higher self, you are in the kingdom of God. That's what Jesus is talking about. The kingdom of heaven is the lowest sephira of Berea, the world of spirit. Spirit is heaven in the Kabbalistic teaching. So the kingdom of heaven is the center point of the world of Yetzirah, the psychological world, or in the chakras, it's the solar plexus, the true self. So when you come to yourself or you center yourself, you're in the kingdom of heaven. So hopefully that alone will help you with interpreting the Gospels. Okay, that is our first webinar. There's an awful lot of stuff to take in, but to sum it up, we've been talking about four levels: earth, water, air, and fire. The four Gospels are on those four levels. Matthew is the world of earth, Mark is the world of water, Luke is the world of air, and John is the world of fire. Matthew is all about the physical world of Jesus. The healings in it are physical healings of physical ailments. Now, each of the Gospels blends through to the other the way the ladder does. So you will find some exorcisms in Matthew. But in Mark, which is the world of the psyche, the world of water, the world of the mind and the emotions, the majority of the healings are exorcisms because they're mental health issues. In Luke, the healings are around family and money, and they're about taking you out of the tribe. In Luke, there are 19 stories of women. In the other Gospels, there are four or five stories. Luke is the one that comes out of the tribe of the time, because in Jesus' time, men were, well, you know, women were seen and not heard, which of course has lasted for a very long time. But Luke makes it clear that the women's ministry is as strong and powerful as the men's. And oddly enough, Luke is the most popular gospel for most people, or maybe not oddly enough, it's the spiritual world. Absolute. John is not, the three ones below are known as the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke. But John is not a synoptic gospel because it's at a completely different level. The whole of John is about divinity. The whole of John is Jesus speaking as the cosmic Christ, as the voice of God in the world. And it's in John that the seven great sayings are, the great I am sayings are, where Jesus is linking through. So your homework, if you want to do it, is to have a look at your favourite gospel. If you want to read all four gospels, do. That's an awful lot of homework. But have a look at one, the one that you like, or just have a quick look through them, or even just read the beginnings. You'll see how different the beginnings of the gospels are. Matthew starts with the genealogy of Joseph. Joseph is the man. Jesus is supposed to be the son of Mary and God, not Joseph. So what the genealogy of Joseph is doing there is basically talking about this. We're talking here at the tribal physical level. So Matthew is saying that Joseph is Jesus' father. He's raising him, whether or not he's his physical father. It doesn't matter in the Kabbalistic tradition whether Jesus is the son of God or whether he's the son of God through Joseph. It really doesn't matter. But Matthew is all about the physical manifestation of Jesus. It's the one with the kings and the gifts. It's the one of earthquakes when Jesus is on the cross. Mark doesn't have the nativity at all. It starts with Jesus' ministry. It starts where Jesus starts coming to himself, where he becomes a real human being, when he becomes a viable candidate for messiahship, if you like. Luke does have the story of the nativity told through the women. It's the story of Mary and Elizabeth. It's the story of the angel and the shepherds. It's the story that says your social status does not matter to God. In Matthew, your social status matters. In Luke, it does not. And John, like Mark, starts off with Jesus' ministry. Goes straight into it. Wham, bam, let's go. So that's your homework. And that's the first session of Kabbalah, You and the Cosmic Christ. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please feel free to send me emails with questions for part two. And I will see you next time.